prescription hits the pharmacy queue before the questions do. A fentanyl spray meant for the last days of cancer patients is suddenly routine. The dose is high. The diagnosis barely fits. The pharmacist hesitates, then fills it. Somewhere else, a sales rep watches the numbers climb and sends a quiet update up the chain. Money moves in small, clean pieces. A dinner here, a speaking fee there. A check that looks earned. Doctors keep prescribing, insurers keep paying, patients keep trusting the white coat and the printed label. Nobody sees the full picture yet or pretends not to. Inside the company, pressure is constant. Sell more. Push harder. Find doctors who will not ask too many questions. Outside, emergency rooms begin to notice the same names, the same drug, the same pattern of collapse. Complaints stack up. Pharmacists call hotlines. Insurers flag claims. The noise grows. By the time federal agents start tracing the money, the damage is already baked in. What began as a sales strategy is now something else. Something criminal. Something that will not stay hidden much longer. Chapter 1, the drug that moved too fast. The order reached the pharmacy early before the rush. A fentanyl spray, high dose, fast acting. The patient was not dying, at least not on paper. The diagnosis code suggested pain, but not the kind that usually justified this drug. The pharmacist paused, checked the profile, then checked again. The prescriber was familiar. The volume was not. Fentanyl sprays like this were designed for a narrow purpose. Breakthrough cancer pain in patients already tolerant to opioids. That was the label. That was the promise. In practice, the prescriptions were spreading. They showed up in suburban pharmacies, small clinics, pain practices far from oncology wards. The drug moved fast, faster than the questions. Subsys was the product. A concentrated fentanyl spray absorbed through the mouth. Powerful, profitable, approved by regulators for a limited population. The company behind it built its future on that approval, then pushed hard against the edges. Sales targets rose quickly. Reps were told growth was everything. Inside the sales operation, pressure was constant. Daily call quotas, weekly targets, leaderboards that rewarded volume. Reps were trained to identify doctors who wrote often and asked little. Those doctors were marked as high value. The instructions were clear. Get in the door. Stay in the room. Keep the product top of mind. At first, the numbers looked like success. Prescriptions climbed month by month. Doses increased. Refills came faster. The drug was expensive, which made every script count more. Revenue surged. Executives spoke about momentum and market penetration. They talked about education and awareness. They did not talk about the mismatch between label and reality. Pharmacists did. Quietly at first, they called insurance help desks. They filed internal notes. Some refused to fill certain orders. Others felt boxed in. The prescription was legal on its face. The doctor was licensed. The patient insisted the pain was real. The system rewarded speed, not skepticism. Insurers noticed patterns. The same drug, the same prescribers, patients without cancer diagnoses. Appeals came in when coverage was denied. Doctors argued medical necessity. Some provided letters. Others pushed their patients to fight the insurer directly. The burden shifted downstream. Within the company, sales meetings took on a sharper edge. Reps were praised for aggressive growth. Low performers were warned. Managers tracked every script. They knew which doctors drove volume. They encouraged more contact, more dinners, more opportunities to connect. Officially, these were educational efforts. Unofficially, they were leverage. Speaker programs became a centerpiece. Doctors were invited to talk about pain management to small groups, often other doctors, sometimes no one at all. The payments were framed as honoraria. The locations were upscale. The food was expensive. Attendance varied. The checks were consistent. On paper, these programs complied with industry norms. In reality, some doctors were paid repeatedly, far more often than demand justified. The correlation was hard to miss. Prescribing rose with payments. High-volume prescribers became frequent speakers. Low-volume prescribers were ignored. At this stage, there were no criminal charges. There were no arrests. What existed were incentives and outcomes. The company insisted it followed the law. Doctors insisted they prescribed based on patient need. Patients trusted both. The gap between intent and impact widened. Emergency departments began to see the downstream effects. Patients arrived in distress, confused, struggling to breathe. Some carried bottles with unfamiliar labels. Staff traced the prescriptions back to the same drug, the same spray, the same dosing concerns. Reports circulated within hospitals. They did not yet reach the public. Sales reps were taught how to handle resistance. If a pharmacist questioned a dose, suggest the doctor call. If an insurer denied coverage, offer guidance on appeals. If a doctor hesitated, emphasize patient satisfaction and rapid relief. The message was consistent. Obstacles were temporary. Persistence paid. Behind closed doors, some employees raised concerns. They questioned whether the drug was being used as intended. They worried about exposure, legal and moral. Management responded with reassurance. The product was approved. The doctors were independent. The company sold. It did not prescribe. That distinction held until it did not. Volume alone was not illegal. Promotion crossed lines when it encouraged off-label use. Payments crossed lines when they became inducements. At this point, the line was blurred, not yet crossed in court, but the pressure kept building. Regulators had limited visibility early on. Reports trickled in. Complaints lacked a single narrative. Each prescription looked isolated. Each payment had paperwork. Each dinner had a receipt. The scheme, if it was one, hid in plain sight. The first cracks appeared in documents. Internal communications later described goals that prioritized dose escalation. Testimony would show that some sales reps were rewarded for pushing higher strengths. Those details were not public yet. What was visible was the result. A powerful opioid moving through communities with little friction. Doctors occupied the center of the system. Some believed they were helping patients. Others responded to incentives. A few would later admit they knew the payments were tied to prescribing. At this stage, those admissions had not happened. What existed were patterns, not proof. Patients trusted their doctors. They took the spray as directed. Some developed tolerance quickly. Others experienced side effects they did not expect. The drug was unforgiving. Mistakes were costly. Families asked questions when outcomes worsened. Answers were vague. By the end of the first year of aggressive growth, the company's revenue curve told a clear story. Subsys had become the engine. Executives praised the sales force. Investors took notice. The warnings from pharmacists and insurers remained fragmented, easy to dismiss. But the signal was growing louder. More calls, more denials, more emergency visits. The same names surfaced again and again, the same practices, the same checks written under the banner of education. No charges had been filed. No wrongdoing had been proven. What existed was momentum, a system rewarding volume over caution, a drug designed for a narrow use spreading far beyond it, and a company riding the wave, convinced that success justified the method. The prescriptions kept coming. The numbers kept rising. Somewhere, a line was being approached, whether anyone wanted to name it or not. Chapter 2, The Checks Behind the Scripts. The money did not arrive as a bribe. It arrived dressed as professionalism. Speaker fees, educational honoraria, consulting payments. Each one documented, approved, and processed through standard channels. On paper, it looked clean. In practice, it moved with purpose. Doctors who prescribed the most were invited to speak the most. Some gave the same talk dozens of times in a year. Others spoke to empty rooms or to a single sales representative. Attendance was rarely questioned. Payment was automatic. The checks landed whether the chairs were filled or not. Sales representatives tracked it all. They knew which doctors wrote the highest doses. They knew who escalated patients quickly. Those doctors were flagged internally as priorities. Reps were encouraged to keep them happy. The instructions were not subtle. Maintain the relationship. Increase the volume. Protect the account. Training sessions taught reps how to navigate insurance denials. They were given scripts. If coverage was denied, guide the doctor on how to appeal. If a diagnosis did not fit, suggest one that might. The language stayed careful, but the intent was clear. Keep the prescription alive. Internal communications later showed a fixation on dosage. Higher doses meant higher revenue. Reps celebrated when a doctor moved a patient to a stronger spray. Managers praised those wins. Performance reviews reflected it. Advancement followed. Doctors who hesitated felt the pressure differently. Invitations dried up. Dinners stopped. Speaker opportunities disappeared. The message did not need to be spoken. Prescribe more or lose access. Some doctors complied. Others pulled back. The company adjusted its focus. Whistleblowers began to surface. Some were former sales reps. Others worked in compliance roles. They described a culture that rewarded bending rules. They spoke of managers instructing reps to target doctors already under scrutiny. They described fear of retaliation if concerns were raised. insurers escalated their complaints. Claims data showed a tight cluster of prescribers driving a disproportionate share of costs. Audits flagged repeated use outside approved indications. Letters went out. Meetings were requested. The company responded with reassurances and documentation. Pharmacists continued to call hotlines. They described patients without cancer diagnoses receiving fentanyl sprays. Some refused to fill prescriptions outright. Others filled them and documented their concerns. The reports piled up, disconnected but persistent. Behind the scenes, federal investigators began connecting those threads. They pulled prescribing data, they subpoenaed payment records, they mapped relationships between doctors and the company. Patterns emerged quickly. The same names appeared across data sets. The same flow of money followed the same flow of prescriptions. Investigators listened to recorded calls. They read emails that framed payments as investments. They reviewed calendars packed with speaking events that never happened. Each piece alone was explainable. Together, they suggested intent. Doctors were interviewed. Some denied wrongdoing. Others admitted they felt pressured. A few acknowledged the payments influenced their behavior. Those statements were recorded. Cooperation agreements were discussed. The wall of silence thinned. Inside the company, anxiety spread. Compliance meetings increased. Legal counsel reviewed practices. Emails warned employees to be careful with language. Training materials were revised. Some payments stopped. Others continued under new justifications. Sales targets did not drop. Pressure remained. Reps were still expected to deliver. The message shifted slightly. Be smarter. Be quieter. Avoid obvious red flags. The machine kept moving. Patients continued to suffer the consequences. Emergency departments saw more overdoses tied to the spray. Families questioned prescriptions after loved ones deteriorated. Lawsuits began to appear. Still civil, still scattered. The public narrative had not yet caught up. Executives maintained plausible distance. They spoke of compliance and ethics in public settings. Internally, performance metrics told a different story. Growth was still king. Subsys still paid the bills. Investigators built their case methodically. They distinguished allegations from proof. They traced funds from corporate accounts to individual doctors. They compared payment dates to prescription spikes. The correlations were stark. Grand jury proceedings began quietly. Witnesses testified. Documents were entered into evidence. The scope widened beyond sales reps to managers and executives. Questions turned sharper. Who designed the program? Who approved the payments? Who knew what and when? Doctors started to panic. Some stopped prescribing abruptly. Others sought legal counsel. A few reached out to investigators proactively. Cooperation expanded the map. Each new statement added pressure. The company's leadership faced a narrowing set of options. Continue as before and risk exposure, or pull back and signal weakness. They chose incremental change. Too little, too late. Federal agents prepared charges. They debated statutes, bribery, conspiracy, fraud. Each count required precision. Each defendant required evidence. The timeline had to hold. No arrests were made yet, no indictments unsealed. Publicly, the company still operated. Privately, the ground was shifting. Employees sensed it. Doctors felt it. The checks slowed. The dinners stopped. The scheme, if it could still be called that, was unraveling. Not because of a single whistleblower or a single document, but because the pattern was too clear to ignore. Money for prescriptions. Prescriptions for money. As prosecutors finalized their approach, one fact stood out. The harm had already spread far beyond any courtroom. Whatever happened next would come after the damage, not before. The charges were drafted. The warrants were ready. The moment of exposure was no longer a question of if, but when. Chapter 3, The Reckoning and the Scar. The arrests did not come with spectacle. No flashing lights outside headquarters. No dramatic walkouts in handcuffs for cameras. They came quietly, through sealed indictments and scheduled court appearances. When the news broke, it landed heavy anyway. A pharmaceutical company built around a single drug was now defined by the way it sold it. Prosecutors laid out their case carefully. They separated allegation from proof. They did not argue that selling fentanyl was illegal. They argued that paying doctors to prescribe it was. According to court filings, the speaker programs were not education. They were inducements. The dinners were not outreach. They were rewards. The fees were not compensation for expertise. They were payments tied to volume. Former executives were charged with conspiracy and related offenses. Some doctors faced their own charges. Others had already agreed to cooperate. In sworn testimony, several physicians admitted the payments influenced their prescribing. They described pressure to keep numbers high. They described fear of losing income if they slowed down. The trials exposed internal communications that stripped away the corporate language. Emails discussed targeting doctors based on revenue. Messages celebrated dose escalation. Calendars showed speaking events scheduled back to back, sometimes with no audience at all. These were not misunderstandings. They were systems. Defense attorneys argued intent. They argued industry norms. They argued that doctors made independent decisions. In some cases, juries agreed partially. In others, they did not. The outcomes varied by defendant. The central finding did not. The speaker program as executed crossed legal lines. Sentences followed convictions. Some executives received prison terms. Others faced probation and financial penalties. Doctors were fined, barred from certain practices, or sentenced to time behind bars. Each judgment carried its own weight. None erased what had already happened. The company itself did not survive intact. Mounting legal costs, civil lawsuits, and lost trust pushed it toward collapse. Bankruptcy proceedings followed. Assets were liquidated. The once celebrated drug became a cautionary example. The brand disappeared, but the product's impact did not. Civil settlements added another layer. States sought compensation for healthcare costs tied to inappropriate prescribing. Some funds were earmarked for treatment and prevention. The sum sounded large. Against the scale of the opioid crisis, they felt small. In court, victim impact statements filled the silence left by corporate exits. Families spoke about loved ones who trusted their doctors. Patients described dependence that grew faster than expected. Some stories ended in recovery. Others did not. The courtroom became a ledger of costs no balance sheet had captured. Regulators responded with new scrutiny. Speaker programs across the industry were reviewed. Compliance departments grew. Documentation requirements tightened. Companies adjusted language and structure. Some practices stopped, others evolved. The incentives did not disappear. They became more careful. Doctors faced their own reckoning. Prescribing habits changed, pain clinics closed or restructured, medical boards issued guidance, education shifted toward caution, trust, once shaken, proved hard to restore. Patients asked more questions, some doctors welcomed it, others resented it. The case became a reference point in medical ethics courses and law schools. It illustrated how legal activity could slide into criminal conduct when incentives aligned the wrong way. It showed how fragmented warnings could be ignored until they formed a pattern too large to deny. There was no single villain left standing. The executives were sentenced. The doctors were disciplined. The company was gone. The crisis continued. Overdose deaths did not pause for court calendars. Communities already affected felt little immediate relief. In interviews after sentencing, some defendants expressed remorse. Others maintained they were scapegoats in a broken system. Both claims carried pieces of truth. The system rewarded volume. The individuals chose how far to go. For investigators, the case closed a file but opened questions. Could earlier intervention have reduced harm? Should regulators have acted faster? How many similar programs still operated within legal gray zones? Accountability had arrived late. For families, closure was uneven. A conviction did not bring back a life. A settlement did not undo addiction. Some found solace in acknowledgement. Others found none. The legacy of the case settled into policy discussions and footnotes, while its effects lingered in emergency rooms and homes. The line between treatment and exploitation had been crossed, proven in court, and punished. The scar remained. In the end, the story was not just about a drug or a company. It was about incentives powerful enough to bend judgment and the human cost of letting them run unchecked. The reckoning arrived. It did not arrive in time.